Hey there, welcome to Blockhead, the Peanuts tribute podcast from a cartoonist's point of view. My name is Jeff Grogan, and I will be your host for the next few minutes to talk about Peanuts, Charles Schulz, and all things Charlie Brown, Linus, Lucy, and Snoopy too. So sit back and enjoy. Welcome back to another episode of Blockhead. Thanks for stopping by. As promised, today we have Lex Fajardo, senior comics editor at Schulz Studio in Santa Rosa, California, as well as a terrific cartoonist in his own right, creator of the graphic novel series Kid Beowulf, published by Andrews McMeel and available everywhere that good books are sold. This is a conversation that I had been looking forward to for quite some time, and it does not disappoint. Lex and I had lots to talk about, both of us deeply interested in Schulz and Peanuts and everything Charlie Brown and Snoopy, as well as comic strips in general. And so the conversation starts off talking about things that, well, talking about where we both grew up, which is Binghamton, New York, and some of the commonalities there, and it leads into a discussion about one of our local hometown heroes, Johnny Hart, the cartoonist and creator of the BC comic strip, as well as Wizard of Id. And from there, it heads deep into Schulz territory. The conversation was so in-depth, and once we got going, we got on a roll, we got really interested. The time flew by without either of us knowing how much time had slipped by, and we never got around to talking about Lex's own work, and we decided we'd save that and for any ancillary issues to come up for another episode, which we will record very shortly. But this conversation was a real pleasure. Lex is a terrific guy, terrific cartoonist, and really, as you'll see, you know, just really, it's a wonderful conversation. So without further ado, let's get right to it, okay? Lex Fajardo and myself in conversation. Here we go. Welcome, Lex, to Blockhead. It's so great to have you here.
Thank you for having me. I've been looking forward to being a guest, and I have really enjoyed the last batch of interviews that you've had. Actually, I guess the whole lot of them. it's been really fun.
Well, thank you. Thanks a lot. It's a lot of fun to do, and it's a lot of fun to talk to other cartoonists about somebody they love and work they love, and everybody, you know, who's anybody working in comics loves, you know, Charles Schulz and Peanuts one way or another. I don't know. Actually, there are people out there who don't, I suppose, but I don't associate with them.
That's right.
I don't hang out with those guys. Anyway, it's great to have you here because you are senior editor at the Schulz Studio, as well as a great cartoonist on your own with Kid Beowulf. So we have lots to... Plus, unbeknownst to the audience, we both grew up in the same region of the country. Matter of fact, within 20 miles probably of each other.
Yeah.
You're in upstate
Binghamton, New York. Yeah.
Binghamton, New York. Yeah. You're from the Vestal side, and
yeah. My dad. We migrated there from the Midwest when I was just becoming a sophomore in high school, and my father's a professor, so he taught at SUNY, where he still teaches.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, and so yeah, when I got to Binghamton, it was it has a very Midwestern feel, so that wasn't so much of a hard shift, but it was one of those, you know, you're moving into a whole new place and you have to find your niche, and for me in high school it was the art room, and I found great friends there, but I spent actually more time, I think, going back and forth to Binghamton from where I am now and all the other parts of my life. So yeah, it is home still. That's where my folks are. That's where my extended family is, and so it's always nice to go back and visit and see what new strip mall has been built in my absence.
Yeah, the Vestal Parkway. Well, okay. So for people who don't live in this region, which is, I actually don't know if I have any listeners from this this town, but for people who don't know, the Vestal Parkway, where SUNY Binghamton or Binghamton University now is located, is basically a land of strip malls, and it's, I grew up here in the '60s when it was just beginning, really, and now and it's still not as overloaded with strip malls as lots of places, but yeah, there every time you turn around, it seems like there's another one.
Right.
It is the fate of America, as it were.
Sadly, yes.
Yeah, I know. And at one point, you wonder when we're going to max out of box stores.
Right.
You know? Anyway, so you know the interesting thing about the place we grew up, which you know, the Binghamton area. I grew up in Endicott, across the river from Vestal. Although the first 10 years of my life were in the Vestal school district, because we lived in a little development called Tioga Terrace. And which was in that school district, so I was gonna go to Vestal, but anyway, 1970, my folks moved across the river, which was a big deal. I thought across the river, when I was looking from the development we were in, across the river, I thought that was like Europe when I was growing up.
Really?
You could see across the river, and I thought, well, over there, that's Germany, and you know, World War II is going on over there. And as kids, you know, we really thought that stuff. But anyway, interesting thing about growing up here is it is also the home of Johnny Hart, of BC fame. And he was, I don't know about for you, but he was, you know, an icon when I was growing up. And he seems to have had progeny in terms of cartoonists here in this area. It seems like it grows cartoonists, because there's you, there's me. There's a guy by the name of Jason Little who does
Oh,
Shutterbug
sure. Yeah,
movies.
Jason.
Yeah. He's from Binghamton. I know there, and his name escapes me. He draws Marvel, those tiny Marvel characters.
Oh, Chris Giarrusso. Chris is great.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yep. Okay. He's from here too. And who knows, you know, who I don't know of who comes from here, but it seems like there's a whole, you know, garden full of little cartoonists who've grown up around here.
Yeah, I think it could be the weather. It's Binghamton is one of the it's in the like top 10 rainy cities,
Yep.
and so all you can do is stay home and draw.
I know. That's exactly it, right? And my wife continually blames me for this. She looks at me and says, "Oh my God, you know, how did you drag me to this place where," because she's a gardener and she loves to be outside all the time, and I can't blame her, because it. But at the same time, you know, as the winter extends, right, deeper and deeper into May, as it did this year, she gets more and more upset, and I'm just sitting there drawing away, you know, feeling it's okay. I just
The
keep
rhythm
drawing.
of the rain on the roof, just as you draw, it's kind of nice. But it can get a little tiresome when it's June and it's still raining. Let me ask you this though. So growing up in Endicott and that area of New York in the 60s when you were, which was kind of the heyday of, well, a lot of Guy Schultz, and then obviously Johnny Hart. Did you feel that presence? Was Johnny Hart like part of the city in the sense of like celebrity cartoonist? What was the, how
Oh
was he
yeah.
perceived back then?
Oh yeah, he was definitely seen as a celebrity. And because, you know, we had two celebrities really from Binghamton. We had Rod Serling
Oh,
and
right.
we had Johnny Hart. And we also had Richard Deacon, who nobody remembers. Richard Deacon was Mel Cooley on the Dick Van Dyke Show. Wonderful, wonderful actor, and a great role, although, you know, didn't really use him to his fullest. But nevertheless, he did get to dance on that show, which was cool. But Johnny Hart was, yeah, by the time I was 10, you know, I knew who Johnny Hart was. I think I knew of who he was before then. I was born in 1960. So by 1970, I was collecting comic strip collections. And I had a collection, I still have it, as a matter of fact, my aunt gave me. And it's a BC collection of a whole host of comic strips. And this is all pre, you know, I think unfortunately among a lot of cartoonists today, Johnny Hart is remembered for his evangelical turn in the 1990s. But prior to that, Johnny Hart was a really witty wordsmith and a very funny cartoonist. And he did a lot of puns and things that were really clever in his cartoons. They
And his drawings are great.
His
A
drawings were
really
great.
great draftsman. Yeah,
Yep, terrific. Very loose, very free. He was a very talented cartoonist, and you know, of the period, one of the greats. I mean, in Peanuts Treasury, I think he writes Peanuts Treasury, or one of those books from the 60s, early 70s. He wrote the introduction for Charles Schulz at Charles
Oh,
Schulz's.
wow.
And I think Schulz wrote the Return the Favor on one of the Hart books. So if you were of the mind to be reading those books, and I was, you knew of the two of them and you knew of their relationship and of their respect for one another. So by the time I was 10, 11, 12, you know, I knew I was heading in the direction of wanting to draw comics. And comic strips were really, you know, I loved Peanuts and loved BC. BC primarily through the books that my aunt got me, and from the notoriety that Hart had.
Right.
So we were, you know, sort of in awe of him, and as well, I was in awe of him. I didn't know any other cartoonists, you know.
Right.
But even my friends who weren't, you know, knew who he was. And so I remember, you know, there's a golf tournament that happens
Right, the
here.
BC Open. I was going to ask. I wondered if he and Schultz, or if he invited Schultz ever to that.
You know, I wonder about that too, because as far as I know, you know, in the 70s anyway, when it first started, and it was a really big deal, Johnny Hart would show up to play, and he would often play around with other golfers. And I went to see him play one time just to see Johnny Hart. My buddy across the street had tickets through his dad. His dad was superintendent of schools in Endicott. And so, you know, he got complimentary passes, which he gave to us. And so we went to see these guys play one day. It was the only time I've ever been to the BC Open. And Johnny Hart, for those who don't know, Johnny Hart had gone through you know, alcoholism. So he had a drinking problem. And when I saw Johnny Hart play golf, he and his buddies, whoever was playing with him, were you know, three sheets to the wind, so to
Oh,
speak, and
really? Okay.
having a great time, and not obnoxious or anything, but they were pretty silly. And I didn't have the courage then to go up and talk to him, but at least I got to see him play for a while. But you know, he got over alcoholism and you know, the whole bit, and that's when he became evangelical. Whatever it takes to get you through the disease, you know. And
Right, right.
a lot of people find God through that. And although I'm not a believer, I don't begrudge anybody what it takes to, you know, find their way out of that morass, because I've
Right.
seen what it can do. But anyway,
Well, you know, the other thing I was going to say is so I think the BC Open was still happening when I had moved in there in the 90s, and it was sort of probably at the tail end. But my recollection of it was that he would invite other cartoonists to it. So there was sort of two components. There was the pro golfers, and then you had the pro-am, which comprised of, and I remember going one year, and I think Mike Peters was there, Mother
Oh,
Goose
really?
Grimm, and Jim
Huh.
Davis, and
Oh,
sort
man.
of the luminaries of the you know, of that late 90s era, or at least, you know, his pals and whatnot.
How cool
So
is
I'm gonna
that?
have to look that up, because I'd be fascinated to know if, because Schultz was a great golfer and
Oh,
loved
yeah.
golfing, so
Yeah.
be interesting if he ever made his way
Yeah.
out there.
You know, I gosh, you know, that's one of those things that I can only dream about. You know, I wish if that indeed happened. I don't know whether I'd regret not being here to have seen it, you know,
Right.
from knowing, but it would be very cool to learn that that was indeed the case. But I don't know that Schultz ever made his way. I mean, this is kind of a bit of a throw from New York City. I don't know if he would have ever come out this far, but who knows? You know, that would have
Right.
been cool. Because you're right, Schultz was a very serious golfer, and although Johnny Hart, I don't think Johnny Hart was a serious golfer. I don't think he took it, you know, he wasn't one of those guys who went out playing all the time. I think he just played as a goof.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. But,
So, Johnny Hart's also interesting if we can, if I'm just thinking about the difference between him and Schultz. I mean, their art style is similar in that it's just great rich black line on paper and fun looking characters. But I think, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but from what I've read of Johnny Hart, he was sort of the style of cartoonist where he sort of had gag men to help him write the strip, and he had sort of a cadre of of assistance. Whereas for Schultz, it was very much sort of the auteur kind of, this is my baby, and I'm the only person writing it. I don't know. Am I right?
Yes, you're right. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I've been reading Celebrating Peanuts 65 years, and I've been going through reading some of those quotes. And
that was
among
the first book that I put together. I'm glad you're reading
it. And it's fantastic. I just love it. I just love it. And I've learned a lot just reading the quotes interspersed with the images, with the comics. It's great. And you know, taken out of context, the comments that Schultz makes throughout are very revealing in and of themselves. And somewhere along the line, he says he was, you know, that United, when they first, you know, signed him on, they didn't know they had a fanatic on their hands.
Right.
And, you know, and I never thought of him as a fanatic, but really, I guess he was, you know, in the sense that this is my baby. I control everything. And, Hart wasn't like that. He was from that, you know, that school of cartoonists, that professional school that was, sure, you know, when you've got a lot of work to do, you hire out assistants and you hire gagmen. And I think he was chastised later on for something cartoonists probably routinely do now, was he would clip old drawings and paste them into new cartoons with new text, you know?
Oh, wow. Interesting. Just, I didn't know that.
Yeah, just to meet deadlines. And I think there was a guy, his best buddy was a guy by the last name of DiCaprio, and I can't remember.
Yes, Jack DiCaprio. So just to interject, because that's how my connection to Hart, very tenuous at best. But when I was doing comics and cartoons in high school, I would do them for the paper, through some person knowing another person, I don't know, but somehow they got to Jack DiCaprio, who was his Hart's writing partner. Uh-huh. And I think this is maybe when I was back out of college and pursuing trying to do a syndicated strip full time. So I sent a batch and to get some feedback from Johnny Hart through Jack DiCaprio. And he was really nice, gracious guy. Both of them really, in retrospect, took a nice chunk out of their day to just communicate with a young cartoonist. Mm-hmm. And I got a letter back from Johnny Hart, and it was definitely the tone of it was an older generation cartoonist, not a fan of the new crop of cartooning that sort of is infiltrating. Huh. And he sort of likened my whatever strip that I was doing at the time as part of that kind of new ilk. Yeah, because at the time I wasn't a very good, I would say my drawing was just trying to figure itself out. And so I was doing a strip called Plato's Republic at the time, which was kind of a hybrid of Doonesbury and Pogo. So there were political themes dressed up with animal characters. And there wasn't a great through line in terms of like the world building. It very much had like a Bloom County, Doonesbury vibe to it. And I remember getting this letter back from him, which was at certain points encouraging, just because, you know, here's somebody who likes cartooning, and so you want to encourage that. But at the same time, it was like, you need to learn to draw, and because the likes of this isn't going to get syndicated. And he sort of, you know, railed against, I think Dilbert had just gotten, syndicated, and there was like a whole spate of comics in the 90s where you could tell the drawing just wasn't as good as Schultz and Hart and Watterson at the time, where there's a clear draftsmanship to it. And it was, and I think so mine, he was sort of putting mine in that bucket. And I think when I got the letter at the time, I was like, who's this guy? I don't care. Blah, blah, blah. I'm going to keep drawing. And it's one of those things, you know, years later, when I reread the letter, I read between the lines and I see what he's saying. It's like, okay, I have to, he's not saying not to cartoon. He's just saying to devote time to learning the craft and getting really good at it, you know, and I appreciate that.
Well, you know, that's fascinating That's really fascinating. I mean, that sounds like a really cool letter to have. And, it's also interesting historically, just from the point of view of one generation of cartoonists looking at the next generation of cartoonists. And definitely, you know, we're talking about a big sea change between the 50s cartoonists like Schultz and Johnny Hart and Jules Feiffer and people like that. Well, not so much Jules Feiffer, but Mort Walker, you know, mm-hmm. people who adhered to, I think, a set of ideals that were rooted in, the great heyday of the comic strip in the 30s and the 40s and the draftsmanship that was on display back then. Plus, you know, that kind of, what do you call it? That kind of very casual approach to drawing that developed in the late 40s, 50s, that approach to cartooning that appeared to be very minimal and simple, like you see in Schultz and in Hart, but was in fact informed by great control.
Oh, yeah.
You know, great feeling for line, and that's something, and I can understand that because again, here I am sitting here at the, you know, just approaching, you know, my elder years, and looking back, and sometimes particularly as a teacher in an art department, oftentimes, you know, I look around and I say, well, you know, a lot of these kids just can't draw. And I can see that in a lot of comics that one way or the other find their way onto the internet and have, you know, 50,000 followers, you know.
Right.
Good.
Right.
Sometimes I almost feel as though good drawing gets in the way of accessibility because it's another thing people have to think about. And they don't, as they're scrolling through Instagram, they don't really want to think, they just want to see. And if it's a comic strip, sometimes really good drawing can get in the way of, you know, perhaps, and I'm just like, this is just coming off my tongue. I have no idea, you know, but immediacy of a joke. I don't know, but
I think there's definitely, it's a balancing act. Cause when I think of what you're saying about sort of that old guard, looking at the new guard, like when I think of those great artists of that time, there's, you know, the really good cartoonists, they strip away, you know, mm-hmm. You sort of just get to the gesture of the pose or the meat of the joke and the perfect phrasing. And there's like, there's this, you're kind of whittling down to the core of the gag. And I think that's what Hart and Schultz and, you know, that generation was really good at doing. And especially in the drawing because you can see it, you know, you can see it in even Schultz's work where that first couple of years, I was sort of just think about it like from the point of view, like as a young cartoonist, like he's just figuring out the landscape. Like, okay, the canvas that I have to work with, these four panels, yeah. How big are my characters going to be? And then how much can I actually fill in there? And it's interesting. Like I think 50 to 51 or two, it's pretty sparse. And then of course, when he's given a Sunday, he really starts to fill in the page. And then for the next couple of years, it really gets jam-packed with detail, and I always sort of liken that to like, oh, he's like finding his sea legs, like he's excited about drawing and he can fill this space and he's getting a bit better handle on his characters. And then of course that landscape gets really crowded, you know, you see the curtains and you see like the Eames chairs in the backgrounds and the Tinker Tot toys, and then it starts to strip away again and he starts to like find exactly the amount of data that he needs to put in that panel that you as a reader need to get to know to understand what Charlie Brown and Lucy and the gag is all about. Absolutely. And it's just fascinating to look at his work. And I think most cartoonists work, if you look at it chronologically, you just sort of see them, at least in strip cartooning, them figuring out those questions for themselves and then how to efficiently put forth the comic that they want to do.
Well, absolutely. I think you've really described the arc of Schultz's artistic or visual development really well, and it's fascinating to me for the same reasons to see the process that he goes through. And sort of, I think one of the things he does is he sits back and he begins to think about, well, how is the reader going to experience this? How is this going to print? What's it going to look like in the newspaper against other comic strips? And I'm wondering, as you're talking, was he You know, did he have a slew of papers, a cadre of papers from around the country that took peanuts and assembled it differently and looked at them and sort of, you know, over time develop an understanding of what's the median, what's the best, you know, place to be visually in terms of the amount of detail, you know, for all of these variations in terms of the way they print the strip or the varying quality of reproduction in those days on newsprint. You know, clearly he was sensitive to that. And right. One of the things in Celebrating Peanuts that I remember reading recently as I've gone through the book is, you know, his talking about reproduction and talking about how, you know, Peanuts was the smallest strip on the page and how he resented that. But I also think resenting that, he accepted it. And he, having accepted it, he learned how to work with it as best he could. And I think one of the things that, in regard to what we were saying before, is that, particularly among younger cartoonists who don't have the experience, is that they are not, they sort of mistake the simplicity of cartoonists like Schultz and Hart and many who come later as a kind of insouciance, as a kind of, you know, disregard for drawing. Right. It's almost like a,
it's a complete drawing, opposite.
Yeah. And it's not, it's really calculated and very, you know, thoughtful. And clearly, you know, in Hart's letter to you and in the things that Schultz says, this is something they've given a lot of thought to. It's not like, because when you look at some of those Schultz cartoons, the Sundays in particular from the 50s, and you look at those, and the level of detail, the deliberateness, the quality of his line, and all of the, you know, the furniture and the landscape, etc. He's clearly considering all of that, and he's also enjoying working with it.
Right.
And he's got the skill level. There's no doubt about it. He's got the skill level to you know, fill it up as much as he wants to. He knows perspective. He knows how to deal with space. But as time goes on, he realizes that in order for this to work, you know, as effectively as possible, you know, I have to utilize the tools I have to the best possible advantage. And that means being aware of every element I'm using within the comic and eliminating those or editing away those that get in the way. And sometimes, for example, there's a strip that strikes me of Lucy and Charlie Brown golfing early on, where adults are seen for the first and only time.
So weird. So weird.
So isn't that weird? And he knew it was weird. And again, from Celebrating Peanuts, there's a quote in there where he says, you know, he knew it was weird and it was a mistake and he looks back on it and he wishes he never did it. But hey, you know, he had to try it. And but he realized that's an element he doesn't need. And he didn't need all of the, you know, nicely rendered detail that was throughout. He didn't need to be Walt Kelly.
Right.
And maybe he didn't even have the space that Walt Kelly had on the page.
And that's sort of what I wonder is, like, when he was finally granted, like in 52, the Sundays, if like he thought, wow, I can finally roll up my sleeves and show these guys, these other cartoonists out there, what I can do. Because, you know, I think, I don't know if he, you know, I know he looked at the comics page all the time because he was very competitive.
Yes.
And he's always sort of seeing, you know, who won the day, so to speak, on the page. So he's very aware of what his colleagues are creating. And I know that early on, for a couple of years, people just didn't know what the hell to make of Peanuts. It was not a out of the gate success. It was a slow build. And I remember reading the likes of Mort Walker and you know, Al Cap, you're like, what is this thing? I don't know what this guy in California is doing, but this is not a comic strip. And so I'm sure he was kind of aware of that. You know, here's this guy in the Midwest who's just drawing about kids and suburbia and with big heads and these weird gags. And it's just so very different that I think people forget that.
It's lucky the internet didn't exist then, you know, trolls, because, you know, maybe it would have hurt him too much because, you know, this is the interesting thing. And I'm sorry I interrupted because you were on a roll there. But the thing that I'm thinking about is that, you know, somebody as sensitive as Schultz was, might have, but also he was stubborn. That's the, you know, mm-hmm. he stuck to his guns. He had a vision and he followed his vision through. And it's interesting how he pointed the way to the future. He understood what was happening to the newspaper comic strip on the page. And he was working with that and towards that end. You can see how somebody like Al Capp could look at the stuff, who said disparaging things about Peanuts and even and made comic strips, you know, that were disparaging about right. Peanuts. And you can see how he, somebody of that ilk could not understand what Schultz was up to in doing that. And yeah, he, you know, he's really carving a path for himself that was, you know, very different really from that of his contemporaries in a lot of ways.
And he's the demarcation point between the, when you think 20th century comics, it's the adventure strips, of the you know, the Hearst papers in the 20s and 30s that he grew up with reading and like wanting to emulate. And then, you know, they give him that what they call the Space Saver strip, this kid who's a fanatic, who's like, this is all you're gonna give me for postage stamps to draw in. And then but as you say, he takes it, he runs with it, he makes it his own, and he transforms the landscape, where from this point on, that's what comic strips look like. That's the beat and the rhythm that he established.
Yeah.
And so when you look at the old adventure strips, it's like, wow, this is what they used to do. It's sort of it's fascinating because he's, and I don't think he did it intentionally. He was just, you know, he was just working with what they gave him. But yeah, he was so damn good that changed everything.
Absolutely. And, you know, he certainly was, you know, so good. And he did, you know, it's interesting. You mentioned rhythm and beat and, you know, in terms of not only in terms of the artwork, but also in terms of the writing style, what was and what wasn't funny, what could be a joke and what could the reader could relate to, and how rhythm played a part, you know, the rhythm of the words played a part in how Schultz's humor hit the reader. You know, there is something to, there are nuances in his writing that I think, say, somebody like Al Capp didn't need to look for, because, you know, first of all, the space was different, the times were different, you know, and Al Capp's illustration was very, very different. But right. Schultz, you know, is mining a territory where something as subtle as the rhythm of words, of language, you know, almost like a haiku, you know, was very important in the translation of the humor of the strip. You had to be able to read Linus, you know, in a certain way. You had to get into the rhythms of Schultz's language in a way. And I think that was very different for the times too. It's still very different, actually. But
it's a character-driven strip. That's the other thing, is like, once you've got a handle on Linus and Charlie Brown and Snoopy, he was writing from their point of view. And that's the one thing I love about, you know, rereading his stuff, is all those characters are so well developed. You know, you don't have to look at a quote to know that, oh, that's Lucy speaking, you know, or look at the drawing. I mean, you sort of just, you can get from the phrasing that, you know, what character is speaking. And I don't know how many comic strips of the time were so focused on the characters. I feel like, you know, Beetle Bailey gags are kind of interchangeable. Sarge could be saying it. Beetle could be, you know, High and Lois, those sort of things. And that's not to say that they're inferior, although personally I think they are. But it's just a different kind of writing that he also brought to comic strips.
Absolutely. I'm using the word absolutely too much. But you know, again, we're in accord. We're agreed. You know, I think that, I agree with you about the writing in regard to Beetle Bailey or High and Lois or a whole host of other strips. The nuances of character that Schultz develops, I think, are something entirely new for the comic strip page. I'm trying to think of other, comics where character is so, you know, developed, so thoroughly developed, and so has so much dimensionality from the 50s. And when you think about, you know, somebody like Beetle Bailey, he's an archetype, you know. But as a person, you don't really, there's no person there to really get to know. He's a vehicle for gags. Sarge is, again, a kind of cardboard character. No disrespect to Mort Walker, who, you know, was, again, one of those benchmark cartoonists, and in a very different way defined what would come after him in terms of what was possible for syndicated comics. He and Dick Brown and that school of comics.
Right.
But Schultz was very, very different. And this is why you can pick up a collection of Schultz and read Schultz and read it over and over and over and get something very that approaches prose, that approaches a novel in its depth of characterization and the depth of its subject matters. Whereas you can read Beetle Bailey, read one book in 1962, read another book in 1975, and it's not going to be all that much different.
Right.
And you're not going to, you know, be engaged in, you know, the foibles of the characters, because the gags are pretty much stock gags. And this is the same thing that's true of BC, really.
Right. You know? I was going to say that because I can't think of a clear personality difference between Peter and you know, BC or any of the other characters. They're just there to deliver the gag of the day. And I suspect that's really the secret to the longevity of Peanuts is, like, you know, he's not thinking of a gag. He's thinking about this character and this situation and what would they do. And that spins out a storyline that can carry him for weeks.
Absolutely.
Whereas these other guys, it's like, okay, what do we got for Wednesday? Come on, let's fill out a note card and get it to the syndicate. You know, it's one of those.
Yeah, and that's why you could hire other people to work with you. You know, get gag writers to work with you, because you could take any gag then and apply it to these characters who are just sort of stock characters in a situation. Whether it's, okay, my character exists in the military, Camp Swampy, or my characters exist in, you know, a prehistoric landscape, of the imagination, and you can just take things and play with them, and it doesn't really matter who the characters are. I think that did set the table for a lot of what is acceptable in the world of syndication. Even today, you know, you think of something like Garfield, and Garfield, as successful it is, it pretty much comes out of the Mort Walker and Johnny Hart school, you know, the Dick Brown school. And, you know, well, the thing that I've always felt with those strips is, yeah, they deliver the gag every day, but there's no real point in reading 50 years of Hagar the Horrible.
Right.
It doesn't go anywhere. And as much as I enjoyed Dick Brown's drawing and you know, his son Chris Brown's drawing and illustration and stuff, and I do find it humorous, you don't go anywhere. And one of the things that I've always missed in and always wanted to inject into whatever comics I was developing, but the ones that I read in particular, is the feeling that this was going someplace, that there was a risk involved, and that you didn't necessarily know what was going to happen to these characters. There was something of value at risk. And in Peanuts, you get that all the way through from 1950 all the way to the last strip. There is never a moment where you feel like, you know, it settles into a pattern after a period of time. But at the same time, there is so much of the personal invested into it that transcends the idea of gag writing, you know.
Right.
I mean, Schultz is still writing gags, but they're, as you said, personality driven, and there's some sense of always a feeling that there are consequences, personal consequences, you know, whether it's Charlie Brown flying the kite and getting caught in the kite-eating tree or whatnot. There's always a sense of something is invested here.
Right. And what I love is if you look at the arc of the 50 years of strips is, each decade, so to speak, has a different flavor. So and I think that's just sort of him growing as a human being and then growing with these characters. So you can you know, there's the heyday of the 60s where everything's just working on all cylinders, and then the fun surrealness of the 70s, and then it kind of like comes into like a, you know, maybe predictable place in the 80s, but there's still really good stuff, and then it moves into this kind of zen-like space in the 90s, and it's just sort of like it's always different, and his batting average was always really good. Like, you know, it's just amazing. And and the other thing I was just gonna, you know, say is that I love that he's commenting on himself. And you can only do that when you have 50 odd years of strips, because like there's some stuff in the 90s where like the kite eating tree gag of Charlie Brown that we've witnessed for 40 years before, he's playing on that trope. He does it with the football gag. He does it with all these things that we kind of take for granted as readers, but he as a creator is playing with. And if you're a careful reader, you'll be rewarded with the gag. Like there's, I think in particular of the one where it's, I think the late 90s and it's a Sunday and Lucy's out there and she's doing the annual football gag and Charlie Brown's racing up to kick it. And then the moment is interrupted by Rerun, who comes in and says, "Hey Lucy, you have a call, you know, you have to go in and get it." And so there's Lucy trying to instruct Rerun, "Okay, well, I'll go get the call, but when Charlie Brown comes back, you just got to make sure that you pull the football away before he kicks it. That's all you got to do." And so, so we cut to Lucy answering the call, and then Rerun walks in and she's like, "Well, yeah, did you do it?" And Rerun sort of says, "Well, you'll never know." And it's, you know, it's that sort of playing on the trope of, mm-hmm. And then other moments with the kite eating tree, and he's like, now I don't know if you know, he's looking back at his work. I get a sense that he really didn't review what had already been done, but clearly it's there. It's in his head. Like he knows all the gags that he's done and always just kind of playing and noodling around for another angle to present it. It's just fascinating.
It certainly is. And I, you know, it's interesting. I don't know the 90s as well as I know the 60s, 70s. And I'm just sort of diving into that material more intently than I have been. But that's brilliant. You know, that idea, that strip that you're talking about is just a wonderful reinvention of that trope. You know,
right.
How to do it, you know, 40 years later and still make it fresh and unpredictable. And I think one of the amazing things about the span of Schultz's career as a writer is while he had these, you know, niches, these tropes that he utilized, these, what's a better word for it than trope? I don't like that word.
Themes,
yeah, that he would return, thank you, that he would return to periodically over and over again over the course of many years. Having read, you know, the entirety of the strip, I only recall like once or twice where a joke might have been repeated in a way that was vaguely similar, you know, to something that had gone
right
before. 50 years worth of writing without repeating yourself. I mean, and yet within the same kind of patterns, you know, he creates these patterns and he utilizes them to spur his imagination, to give himself a set of themes to play off of. But at the same time, every time he does it, he reinvents it somehow. And as you're speaking, yeah, you know, the 90s is a great place in which to start to think about, yeah, he's got to be looking back. I mean, he's had some scares with his health, mm-hmm. and, you know, he knows he's vulnerable. And I think that one of the things that happens as you grow older is you become very conscious. There's only a certain amount of time left.
Right.
And you begin to think about those things. And I think he must have been, you know, maybe perhaps not a nostalgic man, but, you know, most of the material for Peanuts comes out of his youth, right? And so
right. He's
always looking back and pulling more material up. And as so much of his adult life was spent doing the comic strip, then he's mining, you know, that material, working on the comic strip as a subject.
Well, the 90s are really fascinating, too, because you know, the relationship with Charlie Brown and Snoopy shifts. It sort of moves back to being, you know, Snoopy still does his personas and whatnot, but there is a whole strand of strips where it's like about a boy and his dog, or you have those moments where, Charlie Brown is sort of in his bed, lying awake at night, and he has those musings, and then there's also a whole spate of strips where we're just hanging out with Spike in the desert, and it has this kind of weird, crazy cat homage vibe to it, and you kind of like, I always think like, what's going on? What is Schultz thinking here that we're spending all this time with Spike and what is he recalling and what is he, you know? And then you have a whole bunch of strips where Rerun is very much in the spotlight, and so I always sort of think, you know, earlier in our conversation, like, was he looking at the landscape of the comics then? And you think late 90s, well, Watterson was at his peak, and getting all this great all these great accolades, and rightly so. But at the same time, like, Calvin and Hobbes is a direct conduit from Peanuts. So it's like all these new ideas that Watterson had, would, I think he'd be the first to admit, well, you know, they came from the well of Schultz to a certain degree. And so,
oh, yeah.
And then I wonder, like, was Schultz like feeling like as the forgotten cartoonist in a self-imposed exile? So he's just going to hang out in the desert with this weird looking dog and a cactus. Like, I don't know, but it's always fascinating to wonder.
That is really interesting to think about, because, you know, yeah, maybe Schultz sees himself in Spike, and, you know, Needles, California was, you know, this place. He only lived there for a year as a kid, right?
Right.
But somehow it had this impact on his psyche, and he returns to it again and again. And yeah, you know, I've often wondered, what is this focus on Spike? I did read somewhere in an interview later on where he mused that perhaps it was a mistake to spend all that time with Spike. But I wondered, you know, why he would say that, because he really did seem to do it. And there is a kind of, as you said, surreal quality to those comics, because Spike is really speaking to no one else but himself.
Right.
You know, out there. I mean, except for a cactus tree, you know, every now and again, which he'd interact with. And, you know, they're very strange comic strips. I think your analysis is about as good an analysis as I can imagine of you know, the raison d'etre, the rationale for those particular strips, because he seems to be drawn to them again and again.
And I don't think anybody, you know, this day and age with the digital technology of a Cintiq or an iPad, you can sort of, you know, dash off a strip, I think, a little quicker than maybe if you're using traditional tools. And I feel like Schultz was very deliberate about every line that he wrote, every drawing that he made. Like, there was a he spent, you know, hours at the drawing board, and also his strips were big, so they took time. So I feel like, I don't think if he casually just decided to spend, you know, write 400 strips of Spike in the desert for without any, you know, reason. So yeah, I don't know. It's one of those things that when I read the strip, and there are other pockets of the 50 years where you just sort of sit back and think about, well, what was he thinking? And that's what I love about those Fantagraphics books. I think it really opens up the strip in a forward and backward kind of way for us, the reader, that we can kind of dive into, which I think he as a creator, I wonder if he would like that, because he was always hypercritical of the last, you know, batch of strips that he did. He just sort of did them and moved on to the next. So the idea that we can look the whole transom of his art career and think about storylines and where they went, is always, I always wonder about that. Like, it's great for us, but what would he think?
Well, I think, you know, I mean, of course he'd be working on the next comic strip, right? So he'd always be moving forward, but I think he was very proud of his work, right? He was very proud of the work. While in interviews with him, he's always very humble about the role of the cartoonist and the talents of the cartoonist. I also think he took it very, very seriously, right? And I think that he was very proud of the work that he'd done. I mean, he would say in places that, you know, he may not be as revered as Picasso among, you know, museums, but Snoopy and Charlie Brown are better known across the world than anything Picasso ever painted.
And
that's, you know, that's very, very true. But I also think that attendant with that, with the popularity of those characters, I think Schultz also felt that something of the meaning of those characters and the depth of those characters translated to people. They weren't just images, you know, to people who revered them. They stand for more than that. They, you know, they are parts of our collective psyche. You know, there's the wish, you know, to escape the boundaries of oneself that Snoopy, you know, embodies for all of us. You know, in a lot of ways, Snoopy's fantasy world is an outlet for those of us who are sort of, you know, in a lot of ways, surrounded, you know, by the accoutrements of civilization. We're in this late 20th century or early 21st century lifestyle, right? That is regimented. You know, you have a job, you get up at 9 o'clock, or, you know, you get up at 8 o'clock and go to work at 9, and you work till 5, and you get a 2-week week vacation every year, and you live in a, you know, a house with two cars or whatever, you know, your kids are in daycare, and there's a pattern of life that we've set for ourselves, you know, and Snoopy it breaks through that and allows us to break through that. And in many ways represents that quality. And I think that people recognize that when they see Snoopy. As cuddly, he's also cuddly and, you know, and warm.
Right.
So I think that he was, you know, and then of course Charlie Brown represents, you know, that other quality, that feeling of failure that I think haunts all of us at one point or another. And where was I going with this? I'm trying to say that I think Schultz knew what he had done, what he had created, and he knew it was more than just plush toys,
right?
And, you know, merchandising. I think he knew that there was a depth to it that was going to withstand time, and that when you looked at the entirety of it, you were going to have something there that was as vital and as important a work of art as anything produced in the 20th century. And that's certainly, I think that's true. And I think he was aware of it. So I think he'd probably be very proud of that body of work, even though he probably wouldn't pay any attention to it, and he'd just keep working on the next strip.
Right. But it's also interesting, going back to, you know, that Picasso quote, it reminds me of another interview I remember listening to with that Gary Groth was doing with Sparky. And it's a audio interview. And I think he transcribed it at one point. But there's a moment where Groth is saying exactly what you're saying about, like, the breadth of the work and what these characters mean, and like he's trying to ask, he's pushing at Schultz to sort of acknowledge that, and Sparky is very reticent. So you can sort of hear in his voice this push and pull of like, yeah, I've accomplished this great feat, and people in Japan know who Snoopy and Charlie Brown is, and but at the same time he's wrestling with, well, it's just a comic strip, it's just this commercial, you know, piece of art, and like not wanting to embrace the fact that it is art. Like, it's, the genre is comic strips, but it's a great piece of art. And I think, you know, that internal struggle that Sparky had is something we all cartoonists sort of fight with. It's sort of like, well, we're drawing these funny characters on paper, but and they mean so much to us, and hopefully to a reader who enjoys those characters. Yeah. But it's sort of like, it's not an N.C. Wyeth, it's not a Picasso, it's not like a Calder sculpture. It's just like, it's just drawing these funny pictures on paper. And I think that's, you know, in this country at least, that's one of the problems of how comic strip art is perceived, because you don't get that attitude in Europe or in Japan. Like, comics, it's the ninth art. It stands on its own.
Yeah.
But for some reason in this country, we just can't like grapple with that. It's just sort of, you know, put on newsprint and thrown out and moved on to the next day.
Yeah, it's an odd kind of conundrum. At the one time we revere great cartoon characters and want them around us, and, you know, want to decorate our homes with plush toys and you know, blankets and sheets from, you know, Peanuts or Garfield or whomever, or we buy our kids these things. But yeah, we do tend to relegate comics to this world of children's entertainment and dismissible entertainment. And I think that's a holdover in a lot of ways from, the 1950s and Wortham and his approach to comic books and all of that stuff, you know, that ended up in comic books for the next 15 years or so, you know, as a children's medium and being relegated to children's, the idea of children's entertainment. But it is strange, the situation that the cartoonist finds himself in. But there's a closeness to the audience, an immediacy with the audience that transcends, you know, the kind of, museum-bound quality of high art. And I'm you know, I've worked in a university setting for a long time, and I worked, I did, you know, for a long time, I worked as within the realm of fine art, quote unquote, fine art, which is something I, you know, I rail against too. But anyway, there are these divisions that they're artificial divisions, right, that we build up around these art forms. We, you know, there's the museum trajectory, museum bound art world, you know, the gallery world, where cartoons and comics for many, many years have been relegated to the outside. And certainly, you know, except for people like Robert Crumb or Chris Ware, you know, where we identify, okay, this is high art. They can be associated with gallery artists.
Right.
The vast majority of us, you know, are working outside of that. There's a barrier there. There's a wall there. And for us as cartoon, you know, I think there's resentment on the part of some cartoonists, and there's an attitude on the part of the art world. And, you know, those are artificial barriers, you know. I think as Linus often says, 500 years from now, who's going to care? Who will know the difference?
Right.
You know? And I think that's really true. You know, when we look back at ancient art, whether we, you know, we're looking at pottery and you know, Greek vases and urns and the painting of the pottery, you know, maybe it was just a decorative object that was used in the household, you know, at that time. But we revere those things now.
Right.
And, you know, so at some point or another, as cultural production, you know, the impact, say, of comic strips upon the civilization and the culture has really been far greater than that of, say, you know, well, I can't really say that, but, you know, I mean, in terms of the immediacy of its impact, it's been far greater than, say, you know, some of the work that's come out of, you know, the world of high art that I revere, but, you know, and still love, but, you know, Schultz is known by everybody and it's right. impacted everybody. Whereas, say, Ellsworth Kelly's work is, there's a rarefied few who really get into Ellsworth Kelly and or Jasper Johns and know what that stuff is about.
The other thing I would just say on that point, I think those hierarchies are imposed by whoever the body is that is, you know, putting up those
gatekeepers.
Barriers. Yeah, the gatekeepers, so to speak, because the artists themselves would never, I think,
partition loves things. Cat.
Well, and that's the other thing. I was just thinking about Picasso, and I remember visiting, I think it was the museum in Paris ages ago. And the way it's set up, it's you sort of go, I think, from the bottom floor up to the top, and you go through Picasso's life and how he and the art that he was creating through that. And so, you know, the early stuff is very representational, and mm-hmm. and it's, you know, beautiful oil paintings and then it starts to get more and more abstract and cartoony as you move up. And I remember just seeing, like, on the top level, this little painting he did of an owl, and it's a cartoon. And it's like, it's sort of
that whole notion. Picasso was a great cartoonist.
Yeah, stripping away. And I also remember going to this is one of those childhood memories that kind of, you know, always kind of comes back. But it was the first time I read, I think I was 12, I was reading Frank Miller's The Dark Knight Returns. It was a graphic novel, and I was just falling in love with it. And I was reading in the car, and our family was going to an exhibit. This was I think it was like Toulouse-Lautrec. And so we're in the car, and I'm sort of battling with my dad because he just wants me to stop reading this graphic novel so we can get to the exhibit and enjoy it. And so I'm begrudgingly going through this exhibit, looking at this art, and on the wall, I'm looking at Toulouse-Lautrec, and I'm looking, oh my gosh, this is what Chuck Jones was drawing when he was doing those Pepe Le Pew cartoons. Like, those are those images of those crazy French people he would draw and animate. And suddenly, like, between reading, like, my mind being exploded by reading this great graphic novel from Frank Miller, and then thinking of the Chuck Jones, and then the Toulouse-Lautrec, like, it all just kind of, like, came together. I'm like, oh, this is all the same. And it was just one of those, you know, revelations you have as a young kid that kind of sticks with you.
Yeah, there's a and I think you're right. As artists, and this is the important point, it's that artists really don't see those barriers. Artists work across those barriers. They grab right. from whatever, you know, whatever material piques their interest at the moment and spurs them on. And you can look at some of those Picasso etchings, you know, from later in his life. And, man, those are just great illustrations, great cartoons. Picasso was a great draftsman.
Mm-hmm.
But he was also, you know, very capable of doing these very loose and very free drawings that really, you know, come out of the world of the cartoon, you know, or George Gross or any of those people in that world. They're, you know, they're not differentiating between what they're doing and say, except maybe, you know, in terms of notoriety or in terms of, you know, economic value. But,
right.
you know, between what they're doing and what a New Yorker cartoonist is doing or what Charles Schulz is doing, there's a connection there. And, you know, artists are, we're in dialogue with one another across all those boundaries, and we hand things off to one another. And that's why, you know, Picasso could look at somebody like, you know, Harriman and see the quality there when millions of other people, you know, saw barriers. And
right.
Picasso and Braque were like, well, you know, this guy's great. This stuff is hilarious and it's really weird and it's surreal. And I can take something from this and put it into my own work. And the same is true, you know, in reciprocal fashion. You could look at Toulouse-Lautrec or, you know, who's working, by the way, in a popular, you know, medium. He's working in the art of the poster, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is, again, you know, mass media, which I, you know, I've always thought mass media was the true art form of you know, America, you know, in a lot.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
That the true art form was through, you know, almost all the great painters from the early 20th century, the Ashcan School and all those guys, they all came out of illustration. They all came out of illustrating for magazines and newspapers in the late 19th century, early 20th century. A lot of them, made a living, you know, illustrating for newspapers. So in a lot of ways, the really, you know, vaudeville as well as, you know, print publication, the real art of America has always been in that which we tend to disparage and disregard, you know, ephemera mm-hmm. that we throw away. Later on, we realize it's got value. But, what's going to be more important than comics and movies, you know, when we look back at the 20th century and,
right.
And rock and roll, you know? I mean, those are the things that are going to resonate. And, you know, it's the connections between those that are really important. But I think, you know, artists just don't see they work across those boundaries, and that's what's really important, that we're all in dialogue, and those barriers, you know, just serve really, you know, the interests of the powerful, as it were, as opposed to serving artists.
So there you have it, part one of our multi-part interview or discussion with Lex Fajardo, senior editor at Schulz Studio in Santa Rosa, California. And that is just the tip of the iceberg, because our next episode is an extra length, extra extended, giant size issue wherein Lex and I sit down and continue our talk and get deep into what happens at Schulz Studio every day. What do they do? How do these decisions about t-shirts and pajamas and postcards and stationery and books get made? That's what we get into, among other things. And so this discussion goes on. And for me, that was a world I had no entry into and no understanding of beforehand. But we have a really great conversation talking about what goes on at Schulz Studio every day. And I think you'll find it as fascinating as I did. So I want to get that out to you right away. And so I think you'll find it in your feed next week. So be looking for it, okay? Part two of my discussion with Lex Fajardo. And this is just the beginning, because I think Lex has so much to offer. Boy, he's such an interesting guy to talk to. So articulate, so smart. Really with great observations and insight into the work of Charles Schulz. And I can't think of anybody better, really, to be working at some place like Schulz Studio, except somebody as sensitive to Schulz's work as Lex clearly is. And so I'm hoping that, you know, not only will we have a great series here, but very shortly Lex and I are going to continue the conversation, talk about his work with Kid Beowulf, which is a terrific series. If you haven't read it, you can get a taste of it at gocomics.com, but you can also check it out at kidbeowulf.com. That's kidbeowulf.com. You can pick up his graphic novels anywhere that good books are sold, published by Andrews McMeel, and they will not disappoint. They are terrific. Lex has got a vibrant style of cartooning, and he's a wonderful storyteller. So very different from Schulz's work and his work there, but also Very, very satisfying, very exciting, wonderful stories. I just finished The Rise of El Cid, his latest book, and I highly recommend it. So check that out, okay? Be on the lookout for our next episode, because that's going to be up there next week, I promise you. And so thanks for coming by. Thanks for listening. Please be sure to give us a rating at wherever you're listening to your podcasts. If you give us that 5 stars and that little write-up, it really helps draw people there. And please share this with whomever your friends are on social media. That really helps too. I want to get this out to as many people as possible. You know, love of Charles Schulz, love of Peanuts. I want to spread the word and share it as much as possible, especially when, you know, we've got such interesting people to talk to, like Lex, and such a terrific conversation. It's really something that I think all comics lovers would probably enjoy. So please share it and help us get the word out. As usual, hug a warm puppy. I'll be seeing you very quickly next week, okay? So thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon. Bye for now.